Senator Schrader and Representative Krupp. We will thoroughly examine all the items before us, but we will do it in as expeditious a manner as possible. Given that, I will open the Emergency Board General Government Subcommittee for June 22nd, Subcommittee on Education, and we will start with the go to my own agenda. I don't know if I'm not here. With the Department of Higher Education.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You have three items before you, three capital construction requests from the Department of Higher Education, the first of which is a request to spend $7,390,000 of gift funds for improvements at Hayward Field in the University of Oregon.
Good morning, Chair Devlin and members of the subcommittee. For the record, I am Bob Simonton. I'm Director of Capital Construction for the Oregon University System. And the Department of Higher Education is requesting your approval to establish a $7,390,000 other funds expenditure limitation for the Hayward Field Improvement Project at the University of Oregon. The university is actively seeking pledges and will use the collected funds to pay for the project. And today I'm joined with Chris Ramey. He's Senior Director for Planning and University Architect at the University of Oregon. And provide a brief summary of the project, and we're happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for taking time to consider our request this morning. As Bob mentioned, we're here initially for Hayward Field, 7.39 for improvements to the Hayward Field complex. In October of 2005, USA Track and Field awarded the Olympic Trials track and field meet to the Oregon Track Club of Eugene. Partners included in this effort are the City of Eugene, the City of Springfield, and the counties, as well as the Convention and Visitors Bureau, and of course the University of Oregon, who will serve as host. One of the university's components are the facilities improvements to the on-campus facility itself. These include lighting, video board, infield renovations, track resurfacing, improvements to media and operations areas, and other infrastructure improvements and cosmetic upgrades. There are only two seasons available for construction. That would be this summer and next summer, which is why we're here today, hoping to proceed as soon as possible. We're ready to go today. As Bob mentioned, donors are interested in supporting this project. We believe it to be a win-win for the state and the communities and the university. Thank you for your consideration.
The BAM recommendation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Bill McGee from the Department of Administrative Services. We recommend you approve the request.
LFO also recommends approval of the request.
Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that we allow establishment of 7.390 other funds capital construction improvement expenditure limitation for improvements of the Hayward Field project at the University of Oregon.
Any discussion? Any objection? Motion passes. Let's see. Representative Scott, would you like to carry?
Sure.
It will go on to agenda item number 10. Please proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Department of Higher Education is requesting your approval to modify an existing project. This is the U of O's Urban Laurel Union International Lounge project, which was approved in the 2005 session. We're seeking your approval to transfer $305,000 of other funds limitation into Article 11F bond limitation, as recommended by both DAS and LFO. The university's Student Building Fee Committee has also approved this change to offset a shortfall in fundraising. Chris, do you want to provide a brief summary?
Thank you. A brief summary of the project is as follows. Over 1,300 international students attend the university in a typical school year. 15% of our student body study abroad. The Student Union International area is known as the meeting place of the world, and it hosts approximately 200 events a year related to international activities and other studies. The project, of course, as Bob mentioned, has been supported by the students twice, and so we think it's a good deal for them. We concur with the DAS and LFO recommendations to reduce the other funds limitation and keep the total limitation as the same. Thank you for your consideration.
Mr. Chair, Bill McGee from DAS. We recommend you approve the request as it's been presented to you.
LFO also recommends the same thing, which would be to transfer the $305,000 from the other revenues expenditure limitation for this project to the Article 11 F1 bond expenditure limitation for this project. Again, the request is to substitute bonds that would be repaid by the student building fee revenues for expenditures that were originally proposed to be met by gifts and donations.
Do we have a motion?
So moved.
Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, motion passes. Ms. Representative Scott, will you carry? Next item.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, our third and final project before you this morning is a request to modify the U of O's School of Music project, which was approved in the 2001 session. We'd like to increase the other funds limitation by $2 million to offset construction-related inflation. And Chris, if you want to provide.
Thank you, Bob.
Well, the project will provide for classrooms, faculty studios, rehearsal spaces, practice rooms, and renovations to parts of the existing buildings. The request is in response to costs rising due to longer time to raise the gift component of the project and extraordinary inflation costs. About $1.6 million of this $2 million we're requesting today is already in hand or pledged at this time. Thank you for your consideration.
Mr. McGee.
Bill McGee, DAS, we recommend you approve the request.
LFO also recommends that you approve the request to increase the authority for the department to spend gifts on this project by an additional $2 million. We do note one thing, though, just for as a point of information only. This project was originally approved in 2001, some time ago, and because of that, authority to spend on this project will expire at the end of the current biennium. That's to say June 30th. And if this project cannot be completed at that time, it will be necessary for the legislature to extend the timeline, not increase the amount of expenditure authority, but to extend the timeline next session in the capital construction bill.
Is there a motion?
Or
a discussion?
Discussion.
Okay.
This question is not material to the, actually the decision we made here, but I'm wondering if the are there other factors that have caused the delay other than the fundraising?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Thank you.
Do we have a motion? So moved.
I would move that we increase the other funds capital construction expenditure limitation established for the University of Oregon School of Music additions and alterations projects by $2 million.
Any additional discussion of the item? Hearing none, any objections to the motion? Hearing none, motion passes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Morse, will you carry?
Yes.
Department of Education. For five items. The traitor comes out. The traitor.
Still calling you names. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brett West. I'm the Chief Operations Officer for the Oregon Department of Education, and we do have five items on the agenda. The first three will be addressed by Nancy Latini.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Nancy Latini, and I'm the Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships. Today we're going to talk a little bit about the budget note regarding the caseload for early childhood special education, and this really is a follow-up to our presentation in October when we came to you. The budget note requires that the Department of Education report to you on the status of the program, specifically related to the number of eligible children, the actual caseload growth to date, the projected caseload for the remainder of the biennium, and then the amount of any additional funds like individuals with disabilities, education, federal funds, and Medicaid funds. There are really two parts to the Early Childhood Special Education Program. The first one part is the Early Childhood Special Education Program that serves students from ages 3 to 5 or up to the kindergarten age. And this is a required program under federal law. The early intervention part of the program serves children birth through up to 3 years of age and their families. And this is required under state law. Both of these programs are funded by federal and state funds. But unlike the 3 to 5 year old program, the birth to two program is required under state direction to bill for Medicaid funds to help support the program. But in Oregon, in many states, the birth to two program is with another agency rather than the education agency. In Oregon, both programs are under the education agency, so we require both of the programs to fund for Medicaid to supplement and help the program. The purpose of these programs is to really attend to the special needs of students with disabilities as early as possible to provide, either to prevent long-term negative educational effects or to determine whatever specialized supports and services these children need when they get to school. The intent then is to also teach the families to deal with the disabilities and to be able to understand what to expect when they start the school-age program. The 2005 legislative session included a set-aside special purpose appropriation to be used for caseload related to increases in the caseload. In 2003, the legislative session did the same thing, and the department did not request those funds because we had an unusual small growth of caseload at that time, and we did not feel it was justifiable to ask for the money. Right now, we're seeing a very different trend, however. The caseloads have grown substantially, as shown in the chart that accompanied the letter that we sent to you. In fact, the enrollment has grown so much that I had to come in October to ask for the money that was set aside in order to have the program operate through this time. The request at that time was granted. It appears that the special education staff has taken our charge seriously to go out and find the students who are disabled that need services because we see the growth continuing at this point. Let me explain a little bit. In May of 2006, there was a total of 475 more children eligible and being served than there were in May of 2005. In April of 2006, the caseload had a total of 491 more eligible children than the year before. And in February, the program in 2006 had 455 more eligible children than it did the year before. So the growth has been consistent. When we presented to you in October, we gave you the September numbers, which at that time showed an 8.5% increase over the year before. So we expect this growth to continue throughout the year, and some of the reasons that this growth is continuing is that there is a new revised focus on the importance of early childhood education, and there is enough research and data to show that this could prevent further costs later in the school, formal schooling. With this continued growth, the departments and the service providers are finding it very difficult to run the adequate programs, and at the recommended allocation to the end of the biennium. So at this time, the department is requesting about a $3 million set of money to continue these services through the end of the biennium. There is no indication that federal funds will increase, especially considering some of the national needs with hurricane victims and other national disasters at this time. The Medicaid revenue, with all of its changes, will never support a level of reimbursement for any of our programs. In fact, right now we're working with the Department of Human Resources. There is an act in Congress right now to try to change Medicaid and making accessible Medicaid funds for schools even more difficult than it already is. So we're working with them to try to get some information to them. The department also asked that programs take a look at efficiencies that they're doing and to take a serious look at what other ways that they could stretch their money. And there's a chart D in the packet of information that you have showing some of those efficiencies. And if you would just boil those down, if you looked at them quickly, you would see that the practices that are attempted are really looking at trying to stretch the service provider's time with direct services to children and doing that through technology, through collaborative teaching, and also agency collaborations with other agencies. We're also now starting to look at costing out the differences in service options, home visits, direct service, preschool programs that children are in, or separate preschool programs. We've also put out an RFP to ask somebody to come in and take a look at our entire program and see if they have any efficiencies and recommendations to us that we haven't thought about at this point. There were two questions that were asked in October, and one of them, you'll see a pie chart that's attached to your letter that we sent to you. We asked, every year the service providers have to send us a service plan, and part of it is to detail out how they're going to spend the money that's allocated to them. And if you looked at that pie chart, you'll see that 64% of the money goes directly to the teachers and paraprofessionals, with 3% of that 64% going to administrative costs. There's another section of the pie chart that says 23% for purchased services. Really, a lot of that also goes directly to students, because 12.5% of that money are student services, and which means that those are services by people who aren't considered teachers under our coding system in Oregon. So they would be physical therapists, speech and language therapists, occupational therapists, those other kinds of services. 8% is staff travel, which means traveling to homes for the very young children. We do a lot of the training in the homes, and also children traveling to programs, and 7% to building maintenance. I would be happy to answer any other questions that you might have.
On to Ms. McGlashan.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, Sue McGlashan with Department of Administrative Services, and we recommend that you approve the request.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, at this time the Legislative Fiscal Office would make a recommendation that we defer this request. We would also recommend that you establish a reservation in the General Purpose Emergency Fund for the amount that they're requesting of $3,009,549, and recommend that the agency come back to the September 6th meeting of the Emergency Board to request the reservation. I think in doing our analysis, the issue here isn't so much with the request itself. I think this is probably a valid request. I think the agency has done a very good job of working with the providers to become more efficient. I think that they have put some measures in. I think they're moving this program in the right direction. This is an issue more of there are several outstanding issues that probably will become more clear during the summer that are a potential drain on the General Purpose Emergency Fund.
I would concur with that. With the discussions that we've had, I think by making this reservation, we're indicating that we consider this a very high priority, and we will do everything possible to fund it in September. But our unallocated discretionary funds for available to the e-board are very limited right now, and there are some things that could occur that could make them even more limited. We will have the ability, probably, I believe, by late December, to free up some additional funds. But right now, we do not know what the sort of the lay of the land is. In fact, there may be a payment we have to give to counties sooner than we would like to that might have a significant impact on what our discretionary funds are that are left available to the e-board. Hopefully we won't have to do that, so we'll be able to do this. What I would ask, actually, is that we approve this recommendation and for you to know that we'll do everything possible to see that it is funded in September. But at the same time, I would like you to think about what you will do if we do not have the total amount that you've requested in September. Senator Morris.
Thank you. The earlier intervention is mandated by the state, and the early education is mandated by the federal government. Could you elaborate on what the consequences would be if we come fall and this does not rise to the level, or simply there just funds aren't available? What would be the consequences?
Chair Devlin, Senator Morris, we did ask the service providers that very question about what would it mean if we didn't get the money, as well as what would you do if we did get the money. And the issues really go around three topics in my mind. One has to do with staffing, one has to do with accountability, and one has to do with unrest of parents who are expecting and have services provided to them under these programs. The staffing issue is a real one. Special education teachers are one of the most difficult teachers to secure. And I just learned yesterday that the shortage of special education teachers is great nationwide, but for some reason the West Coast is hit the hardest. And we spent yesterday trying to figure out something to do about that. But for programs like this, laying off the teachers or not having the teachers and cutting back on class, increasing class size and having fewer teachers, those teachers will be picked up in other programs quickly if they're certified, and they all are certified. And so, again, taking a look at if they got the money and trying to find the teachers may be delayed. What that would do is increase the class size for teachers, more travel probably for some teachers to get to homes and families, and the issue around accountability of what we've committed to in the program plans for these students. And there would be the parent unrest of saying, oh, why are we cutting back on services?
What would be the consequence from the federal government?
If there were complaints for the parents, we would have to deal with those through the government. If we were not complying with the basic rules of the laws and what it says that we have to provide services, they could withhold our funds.
Thank you.
Do we have a motion to approve the LFO recommendation at this point?
Mr. Chair, I would recommend that we defer the request for the allocation. However, that we also establish a reservation of $3,009,549 in the General Purpose Emergency Fund and recommend that the agency return to the Emergency Board in September of 2006 to request the reservation.
Thank you. Any additional discussion? I do want to say again that we will do everything possible to try to ensure that the funds are available in September, and I believe that the leadership of both the Senate and the House are committed to that. But we do want to exercise a little bit of caution at this time. Any objections to the motion? Hearing none, motion passes. I will carry.
The next item that I'm here to discuss with you this morning has to do with the State School Study Committee. This committee was formed in response to a budget note from the 2005 legislative session to review the Oregon State School for the Blind and the Oregon State School for the Deaf. The focus of the study was how is Oregon serving the students who are blind, visually impaired, deaf, or hard of hearing. The membership of the committee was listed on the summary that was in your package in your letter that we sent to you. You can see from that list that we had a variety of perspectives and skills, a variety of interests and knowledge on the 20-member committee, including legislators, parents, union representation, advocates, representatives from higher education that are specialized in these two areas, state board representative, and district and ESD superintendents. The task was enormous, and the committee did understand that we had to go beyond just the budget note in order to understand what the recommendations, to make recommendations. Basically, the budget note asked us to consider moving the Oregon School for the Blind campus onto the Oregon School for the Deaf campus and to look also at contracting out both programs to another public education entity. Before I go any further, I want to give you a context of what these schools are like so you know what the work of the committee was. The Oregon School for the Blind has an enrollment of 32 students. The number has remained pretty steady over the last 8 years, so there has been just a drastic decline. A high point was 52 students in 2000-2001, and the low point was this year of 32 students. The population has changed somewhat over the last few years, with most of the students being older and many of them having multiple disabilities, not just being blind or visually impaired. So this has changed the focus of the program somewhat, but we did learn that the basic mission of the school has not changed, and there was no documentation to that effect. But what it does say is that districts are referring older students, and we could guess that perhaps part of the reason is their inability to work with students and the requirements of the transition transition from school to adulthood and are looking someplace else for that expertise. It's also maybe telling us that parents aren't as willing to send their children away from home to go to school, and that districts are more able to serve the young children with proper supports and services that then allow them to stay in their communities and community schools. The Oregon School for the Deaf has a population of 121 students. Close to 50% of those students are day students, and they don't use the dormitory option. They go home every evening. The enrollment for this program, too, has remained fairly steady, with a low point of 119 students in 97-98 and a high point of 137 in 88-89, so there isn't a big swing in population. The campus is spacious and right now has space that's rented to Salem Kaiser Charter School, Head Start program, and some community agencies. All of the students in both programs go home every weekend. It used to be a weekend program, and there isn't at this point. The committee members agreed to a set of standards that they wanted to look at everything against, and I need to just let you be aware of what those are. First and foremost was to demonstrate fiscal responsibility through sharing of whatever expenses would be feasible, such as staff, equipment, materials, maintenance, and care. Nobody on the committee argued that the cost of serving this population at the current rate was exorbitant compared to the cost of other students that have similar or even greater challenges in special education. The question then became one of what are some different ways to produce the results that we need for children in this century and in the future. Also, they wanted to make sure that we had a system designed that we always tracked with the districts, the school districts are requesting. This program is to serve districts who cannot properly serve students who either are deaf or blind. And so to look at the referrals, why are districts referring certain kids, and what does that look like, and what does that tell us about what we're offering at the state schools? And the final set of value that they wanted to make sure that they measured against was making sure that we could demonstrate positive, realistic outcomes for students by examining past outcomes, how long does it take students to graduate, what happens after graduation to these students, and do they return to the school or go in and out, and why would that happen? So this would be something that would be important to us, because similar to any other education agency or entity, these programs are obligated to produce and craft outcomes which would give us well-rounded, educated graduates that are either ready for college or ready for the world of work. The committee met several times since December. They spent much of their time getting their arms around the budgets, the staffing patterns, the operations of both schools, as well as looking at our 8 regional programs who serve the same population, and the difference being that those students in the regional program go to their local schools and live at home. They also had site visits to both of the programs. As of today, there's a draft of committee recommendations that have been crafted. We shared those with Superintendent Castile. She asked us to go out for public input. We've had 3 hearings. We're going to have a 4th one on Tuesday of next week. And we also have an email address where people are encouraged to send their comments to us on the recommendations through an email. Excuse me. And this the email address will be open until July 7th, and after that time we'll analyze all of the comments and go back to the superintendent so she can prepare some formal recommendations. The hardest part of the committee's job is to really cost out the actual recommendations. There were many recommendations that depended on other entities. For example, at one meeting, the committee asked to see the detailed budget for the regional programs for both serving students who are deaf and hard of hearing or students who are blind and visually impaired, because if they made some recommendations, they wanted to see what the impact would be on those budgets as well. So we really delved deep into things. The reason of the difficulty of looking at some of the cost analysis is we would be measuring against what is right now. And looking at contracting out, for example, we're not sure the final recommendation would we be contracting out what is, or would we be contracting out one campus only, and so those would make a big difference. On March 30th, the Joint Legislative Audit Committee asked us for an update, and we presented to them. They've requested us to go back in November again. Essentially, the recommendations, and I know you have those in your packet, were closing the campus of the Oregon School for the Blind and moving the instructional program onto the campus of the Oregon School for the Deaf, where there is space and we allow for a reduction in operations and administrative costs, and yet maintain the same level and quality of instructional programs for those students. We also needed to take a look at what the programmatic focus is to make sure that we're giving what districts need, and also then to consider removing the Oregon Department of Education from the business of running schools and have some other public entity do that. This is, again, as I said before, the difficulty of conducting a concise cost analysis of contracting out until any changes do occur would be difficult. So the superintendent is asking for us to look at that later to consider that as an option, but to look at the other options first. We have expertise and oversight of programs, but again, we have no assurance that that would save anybody any money if we contracted out at this point. I appreciate having the time to update you on this committee's work, and I'd be willing to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions? I did have a question and partially a statement. I have heard from a number of parties surrounding the school for the deaf and the school for the blind, and I have not heard a great deal of concern about combining the two. What I have heard is a concern that I do not believe that the Department of Education would entertain, and that is that, well, you already, in terms of the school for the deaf and the school for the blind, the children have a higher percentage of other challenges than the average school population. But there is a concern that somehow districts could look at this as a place to put children with other major disabilities other than being blind or other than being deaf. And that would make the very challenging task that the school has to perform an almost impossible task. And I've assured them that I did not believe that the Department of Education would entertain the school not receiving children that were not either deaf or blind. Is that an accurate statement?
Senator Devlin, you're very right at that. In fact, if you look at one of the recommendations, it is to make sure that we have clean criteria for those programs and that we are serving the right students in them.
Ms. McGlashan.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, my understanding is that BAM does not make recommendations on reports, but if we did, we'd recommend that you acknowledge receipt.
Ms. McGlashan, you know it's your replacement here, Mr. Hill, very capable, but you're still missed.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hill.
Yeah. Well, thank you. My recommendation would be to acknowledge receipt of the report.
Do we have a motion to acknowledge receipt of the report?
So moved.
Okay. Any additional discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, motion passes. We'll go on to the next agenda item, and I'll carry the report.
The next agenda item is another update for you on a budget note that resulted from the 2005 legislative session regarding the Oregon Youth Corrections Education Program, or YSEP. This budget note directed the department to report to work with the Oregon Youth Authority regarding the education, including post-secondary needs of youth who are served through the YSEP program. And by doing that, they asked us to work with a group of representative stakeholders who are interested in education of kids in correction programs to recommend funding options to address the education services for the incarcerated youth who are between the ages of 19 and 25 and or already have a regular high school diploma, and then reporting those back to several agencies. The department did convene the task force to look at all of this. Again, a little bit of context for you. All of the youth incarcerated in the Oregon Youth Authority facilities across there are 10 of them across the state of Oregon, are included in the YSEP program under the Department of Education. We are charged with the responsibility of providing education for any of the students in these 10 facilities, and we contract with the local education agencies for that purpose. Each student, including those between the ages of 19 and 25, and those who have obtained a regular high school diploma, are reported to the average daily membership, or ADM, and each student generates a state school fund revenue of a double weight. The statewide, approximately 840 students are in these 10 facilities, and of that, about 170 of them are in this population that we're talking about between the ages of 19 and 25. We have the responsibility to provide the educational services, and we currently claim these students under the state school fund, even though this group of students and youth do not are not identified or defined as students under the state school fund definition, and approximately $3.5 million for this biennium is used for this purpose. The LISEP task force recognized and worked very hard on the needs of these students and came up with some very good educational decisions that we really do want to look at. And relative to the direct recommendation or charge that we look at funding options, they had a little bit more difficult time figuring that out and came up with one talking about funding the services generated through possibly a separate general fund appropriation related just to these students. The management of these programs that are affected would be, of course, the Oregon Youth Authority, the College Workforce Development Agency, and the Department of Education. So the managers of those programs also met and reviewed the report and felt that there was a lot of wonderful recommendations that we want to pursue as far as the education of these students. But as far as the funding options are concerned, and the one that what was presented was fine, and we also thought that we could look at some other recommendations that we would need to cost out, one possibly being that we change the statute so that this group of students could fit under the funding option that we currently have. Consider also reconsidering or looking at the formula weights for this group and then making sure that we're collaborating across agencies to be as efficient as possible. So at this point, we need to still present to the Interim Education Committee and to take a look at some kind of agreement to move forward on whichever action we need to take. I'd be happy to answer any questions for you.
And Das is saying it's okay even though they don't.
Mr. Chair, I would recommend that you acknowledge this in the report.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Is there a motion to approve the report?
So moved.
Any additional discussion? Any objections to the motion? Hearing none, motion passes. I will carry that also. Item number five.
Mr. Chair, again for the record, my name is Brent West, Chief Operations Officer for the Department of Education. We are here to request the release of $153,961 from a special purpose appropriation for local option equalization grants. We did receive an appropriation of $400,000 during the legislative session, plus the reservation of $800,000 in anticipation of getting more accurate information. You can see in the letter that, or the accurate information during the course of the school year. You can see the districts in your letter that are eligible for this grant. And I've asked Brian Reeder, our assistant superintendent for school finance, to come up to the table in case you had any questions on the specifics of the local option equalization grant account. But we are here to request the release of the $153,961 with the understanding that we'll come back in December once we have updated information for the upcoming school year.
Any questions? Ms. McGlashan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. BAM recommends that you approve allocation of $153,961 from the special purpose appropriation for the local option equalization grants.
Mr. Hill.
We concur, and our recommendation would also be that you allocate $153,961 from the special purpose appropriation to the emergency board for local option equalization grants.
Mr. Reeder, would you just give a brief so that the members of the legislature up here understand exactly what this is, but could you give a brief explanation for the record?
Sure. At the time the legislature was in session, Hood River County School District had a local option levy pending, and at the time it wasn't known whether it would pass or not. If it did pass, then we estimated that the grant program would pay Hood River a relatively large equalization grant on the order of $400,000, which was per year, which really dwarfed the equalization grants being paid currently to the districts that were already receiving them. So in the face of that uncertainty about whether their levy would pass or not, the legislature chose to allocate the additional $800,000 to the E-Board in case the Hood River levy did pass, and it in fact did. And so for the 05-06 school year, Hood River County School District qualifies for an equalization grant of $384,000 for 05-06, and for 06-07 we anticipate it will qualify for one roughly of that same magnitude.
And can you briefly explain that this relates back to ballot measure one, and that for school districts that their assessed value, can you briefly explain the formula? It brings them up to three-quarters.
Yes, Senator Devlin. The purpose of this grant program is to provide additional resources to school districts that pass local option levies but that also have relatively low assessed value per student. The intent is to provide additional resources to bring those districts the revenue from their local option up to a level as though they had higher assessed value per student than they actually have, and the level that was chosen to bring them up to was the 75th percentile of assessed value per student. So essentially it gives a grant to districts so that their revenue from a local option is as high as it would have been had they had the 75th percentile level of assessed value per student. It's what in tax circles is called the power equalization formula. It gives districts the power to raise revenue as though they had higher assessed value within their boundaries, and it's an equity provision that allows relatively property poor districts to raise more money.
Any additional questions from the committee? And the LFO recommendation is favorable.
I read it. It was, again, the LFO recommendation is to allocate $153,961 from the special purpose appropriation to the emergency board for local option equalization grants.
Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I recommend we allocate $153,961 from the special purpose appropriation for local option equalization grants.
Any additional discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, motion passes. Senator Morris, will you take this motion? Okay, we'll go on to agenda item number six.
Mr. Chair, again, for the record, Brett West, Department of Education. The purpose of this request is to seek additional federal funds limitation based on updated federal revenue projections that we have that are more current than we had during the legislative session. As you can see in the letter, the single biggest item is for federal Carl Perkins vocational technical education funds, and at the time of our Ways and Means hearings, we were receiving indications that the Perkins funds would not be continued in the second year of this biennium. We did find, however, that they have been continued. That is $12.6 million of our $14.2 million request for increase. I will stop there and answer any questions that you may have.
Ms. McGlashan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the subcommittee. BAM is approving some modification to the agency's request, and that's detailed in both the LFO analysis and the BAM analysis, if you have one of those in front of you. Basically, what BAM is recommending is that you increase the federal funds expenditure limitation for various grant and aid programs by $18,185,189. And the detail for that number is in the body of the analysis. If you turn to the section grant and aid programs, you'll see that there's an increase of $2,223,039 for Title I-A grants to local education agencies, an increase of $104,765 for Title II-A teacher quality grants, and $12,602,716 for Voc Ed, and finally $3,254,669 for all other programs. There would also be an increase in department operations federal funds limitation of $1,000,000 $3,248, an increase of $129,258 in federal funds limitation for special schools. And in addition, the Department of Administrative Services will unschedule federal funds limitation in those areas where it's actually decreased, and that would be from what was expected in the LAB. And that would be $163,021 for the Youth Corrections Education Program, $4,943,246 for the Grant and Aid Program Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, and then $32,114 for the Grant and Aid Title I-C Migrant Education Program.
Mr. Hill, your recommendation is slightly different.
No, actually, my recommendation matches budget management's recommendation. So rather than read that all back into the record, Ms. McGlashan did an excellent job of covering all those numbers. I followed along, so we would match her recommendation.
Any additional discussion? Is there a motion to approve?
Just a question.
Yes.
Sure. We are increasing the Fed funds limitation by $19,317,000 and then unscheduling $5,138,000. Looking at the tabulation and the issues that are giving cause to the increase, I don't see the reference to the $19 million. Can you direct me to how we get to 19?
Chair, if I might, if you look at my recommendation here to the right, basically the increase, if you total all of those that need additional limitation, that's the $19,317,695. Those that need a decrease will be the unscheduled amounts of $5,138,381. The net is a net increase of $14,179,314 on an agency-wide basis. So it is a little confusing, but the negative amounts are being requested to be unscheduled.
That's what I kind
of okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I thought Bam's recommendation was 18 million, but it is the 19,317,695.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, it is. It would be the 18,185,189 in grant and aid,
okay,
and then the million
it.
Plus change in operations and the small amount in state schools add up to the 19 plus.
Glad million. That I was not the only one up here that wasn't clear on that. Okay, we do have it clear now. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I recommend we increase federal fund expenditure limitation by $19,317,695 and request the Department of Administrative Services to unschedule $5,138,381.
Any additional discussion? Any objection? Hearing none. Motion passed. Thank you. Senator Morris, will you carry?
Yes.
Department of Revenue.
Mr. Chair, may I invite Pete Shepard from DOJ to join me since
yes.
we have linked requests?
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Harshenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. We have a request for an increase in expenditure limitation before you today. What I'd like to do is, because the expenditure limitation request is related to the activities of the Tobacco Compliance Task Force, I have representative of one of our two partner agencies with me today to help review what we're doing and explain further the context for the requests. Our other two partner agencies are the Department of Justice and the Oregon State Police. Just as a little bit of background, in 2001, the legislature authorized creation of our three-agency task force. We have 19 folks who are working on all administration and enforcement for both the cigarette tax and other tobacco products tax in the state. Revenue Department is responsible for sort of the administrative side, which is selling cigarette tax stamps and collecting the revenues from those sales, receiving returns and payments for other tobacco products tax, and then in the compliance arena, assuring that retailers and wholesalers are complying with the law in terms of selling products that on which the tax has been paid, doing administrative investigations and audits, and working with our law enforcement partners on issues where it appears that there may be some criminal activity that's taking place. Our requests are related to the manner in which the task force is funded. The tobacco taxes altogether are projected to generate just under $500 million over this biennium, and the three agencies' costs for their work are paid out of those proceeds. It all flows through the Department of Revenue's budget. And the budget that was approved for this biennium by the legislature was about $3.5 million. I'd like to ask Mr. Shepard to review sort of the law enforcement side, and then I'll come back to the specifics of our two requests.
Mr. Shepard, please. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. As Ms. Harchenko has indicated, this is a three-part, three-agency partnership that this assembly formed originally in 2001. Really is, at the time it was formed, I believe it was the only such integrated unit in the country. The basic theory of the unit is that we integrate the law enforcement, administrative enforcement, and the investigative components of all of those entities together with the idea of doing the investigations and then determining what the appropriate remedy is for the unlawful conduct that may have been collected, and indeed the remedies that the task force have invoked to maximize returns on for the state in this tax area range from simple persuasion to criminal prosecution. The law enforcement component of the task force does include Oregon State Police, a contingent of detectives, and a supervising sergeant. And the Department of Justice, for its part, also provides specialized investigative support in the form of financial analysts, prosecutors, and other staff. And so the combination of those folks work together. They're co-located, and they share information freely back and forth amongst themselves to try and identify, as I say, the very best remedy for the unlawful conduct that's been detected. I want to focus just for a second on one subset of the remedies that the task force has used to maximize these revenues, and that's what's referred to in the materials that have been submitted to the committee, both in conjunction with the specific agenda item that Department of Revenue brings, and also the next one on your agenda, number 28, the Department of Justice request for acknowledgement of its report. And that specific remedy is referred to as the Jenkins Act. That is a federal statute that requires interstate shippers of sellers of tobacco products to report to the taxing authority of the state to which they're shipping those products for consumption, to report the identity of the customers in that state. That's important to Oregon and the other states because the structure of the tax generally is that it's the consumer that really owes the tax. And so it's the purchaser of that product that really ultimately is responsible for paying the tax. In the kind of brick-and-mortar transactions that we're probably more familiar with, those transactions, the tax is collected as a matter of convenience at the distributor level, but really the tax as a matter of law is owed by the consumer. And so in the interstate transactions, often in these days initiated by Internet connections in which consumers in Oregon go to an Internet-sized site, place an order, typically pay for the order with a credit card, and then ultimately receive shipment of the tax. The Jenkins Act says that the shipper is supposed to tell the Oregon Department of Revenue
to whom the goods were shipped. Before the task force began operations, and indeed really before this last biennium, starting in the last biennium, there hadn't ever been any significant enforcement of that Jenkins Act requirement. It was widely ignored, it probably doesn't even go too far to say that it was universally ignored by the shippers of tobacco products. The task force has taken a very aggressive role in seeing that those Jenkins Act reports do flow to the Oregon Department of Revenue as they are supposed to under federal law. That's included recovering materials and records in the course of carrying out its criminal activities, but it also has included using the task force's resources to help stimulate a national effort that actually resulted in getting cooperative agreements from four national credit card companies that they wouldn't allow themselves to be used in transactions that circumvented the Jenkins Act requirements. As a result of that, the Department of Revenue has secured lots of information about Oregonians who have not paid their taxes as required by law. And the Department of Revenue has then begun as a pilot project to follow up on those. And it's partly that specific effort that brings us here today.
Thank you. Returning to the request by the Department of Revenue, we're asking for an increase in our other funds expenditure limitation by a total of $786,315 for the activities of the Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force. And there are two pieces to the request. The first is the way the dollars flow in order to reimburse the Department of Justice and the Oregon State Police for the work that they do as a part of the task force is it comes through our budget as a professional services item. And in budget development, professional services typically are given a standard inflation growth factor. Our two partner agencies in their the work that they do is primarily personal services, and the increases to personal services line items are different than the standard inflation factor. So we just had a mismatch, and so the request for $538,315 is just to bring revenues expenditure limitation up to the costs that were approved by the legislature to be spent by our two partners during this biennium for their compliance-related efforts for the task force. The other $248,000 is related to the Jenkins Act compliance work that we've begun to do now that we're getting reports from the interstate sellers. And this is specifically related to sellers who market over the Internet. Distributors who are physically present in Oregon are stamping cigarettes that they're distributing, but entities that don't have any presence in Oregon at all, we don't have a way to compel them to stamp the cigarettes that they're selling. So this is the substitute for that. And we did a pilot project after those reports started to come to us after the work of the Attorney General's office. We sent courtesy letters to about 7,500 consumers and received payments of almost $700,000 of cigarette tax that was owed with respect to the cigarettes that they purchased over the Internet, and we spent about $88,000 on that project. We have another 23,000 pieces of information to process, and we expect to get about 1,400 a month over the rest of the biennium, and so we project we'll need about $160,000 to pursue collection of the taxes due on those transactions. We need to do the work where we can do it most efficiently rather than have our compliance specialists in the task force do the basically clerical and administrative work to get the letters out, calculate the tax, get the letters out, and process the payments. We want to do that in our processing operation, and we need to be able to pay for the time of the staff that will be added in that area. So it's to reimburse us for the work we've already done and then to pay for the same kind of work ongoing through the rest of the biennium. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
First, we'll go to Ms. Sains. Ms. Sains.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I'm Linda Ames with Department of Administrative Services, and we recommend approval of the request.
Dallas.
Yes, Legislative Fiscal also recommends approval of the request.
Okay. Are there any questions of any of the parties or any comments? Yes, Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there anticipated that there would be customers that still will not? Let me ask the question a different way. Your request of $248,000, is it still leaving an unmet collection opportunity?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore.
Of course, there.
Well, quick math.
Tobacco.
I don't smoke, so. I didn't mean that. You got an 8-to-1 collection to cost ratio, which is pretty good. You're collecting $8 for every $1 you're spending on this. I'm wondering, are we pursuing it as diligently, moderately, or are there other areas that, or additional revenue that could be collected that we're not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, with respect to following up on the reports we get under the Jenkins Act, we believe that this amount of funds will cover the cost that we need to follow up on all the information that we get during this biennium. In the tobacco arena, things are always in flux. And as we develop a strategy to address a particular compliance problem, like people purchasing cigarettes untaxed over the internet, something else will pop up. And that's why the partnership is so valuable. What we would expect to do is we believe we've got an appropriate size task force, an appropriate amount of revenue expenditure limitation if this request is approved, to fund our activities at an appropriate level for this biennium. And if something pops up for us that was unanticipated or is a new way of avoidance, we would be expecting to report that during our budget conversations in the regular session as we look forward to the 07-09 budget cycle. But at least at this point, we think we've got what we need and what we can use most effectively.
Mr. Chair, if I might add for Senator Morse's benefit, I think there's another benefit of the Jenkins Act enforcement that I think we wisely have understated or made very conservative, but nonetheless I think is real. And that is that some number, and we don't know exactly how many for purposes of your agenda item number 28, our report, we assumed half of the consumers who previously purchased over the internet would switch to buying their product at a brick-and-mortar outlet because they would recognize that it costs just as much to get the material down the street. So not only do we have the collection of the past due tax from that consumer in terms of that ratio of recoveries, but there's some number that's associated with the ongoing recovery of tax that otherwise would not have been recovered but for the enforcement action. How large that is involves an element of judgment that makes it very difficult to attach a specific number to.
Glad to hear there's an economic development portion of this.
Well, we have heard, Mr. Chair, actually anecdotally from distributors that the activities of the task force have resulted in increased sales for their local activity.
Senator Morse, did you have a follow-up?
No, we'll wait till next session. Thank you.
Okay. Do we have a motion?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would move that we increase the other funds expenditure limitation by $786,315 for tobacco tax compliance task force activities.
Is there any additional discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, motion passes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott will hear.
Okay.
Thank you.
Chair and members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I'm here on your agenda item, I think, 28, which is the request of the Department of Justice that the Emergency Board acknowledge receipt of the report dated May 26th to this committee. I would incorporate by reference, by background, the discussion we've just had with the Department of Revenue on the previous matter. The report specifically concerns two positions within the task force that you've heard previously described. One is a limited duration Assistant Attorney General position, and the second is a limited duration financial investigator position, both of which were authorized by the Assembly last session to be augmentations to the Governor's recommended budget, and as to which the funding was approved, but $175,000 of that was unscheduled pending acknowledgement of this report. I won't go over, as I say, the same material we covered just in your previous item, but I would say as to these two positions, they have been key positions in being able to generate the kinds of returns that you heard described earlier, in particular the individual AG who has done some of the work on the Jenkins matter is one of those individuals whose activities resulted in the recoveries that you've heard previously. With that, I would stand open for questions.
First, we'll go to Ban. Your recommendation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Kelly Friels with the Department of Administrative Services, and this is a report that was requested by the 2005 legislature. Assuming positive action by this body, we would reschedule the $175,000.
Mr. Wilson?
LFO recommends acknowledgement of the receipt of the report and also requests that DAS reschedule $175,000.
Are there any questions? Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that we acknowledge receipt of the report and request the Department of Administrative Services reschedule $175,000 other funds expenditure limitation.
Motion on the table. Any additional discussion? Any objections to the motion? Hearing none, motion passes. Representative Scott, will you carry?
Pardon me? Which one are we doing next?
Item number 29. Please proceed, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I'm here on the Department of Justice's request that the Emergency Board approve our acceptance of a $175,000 grant awarded to the Department of Justice by the United States Department of Justice. This is a continuation of a grant. This represents year two activities under what is anticipated to be a three-year grant. The first year of the grant was the federal money was used to assess and then develop a plan for improving statewide compliance with various requirements that victims be engaged in the criminal justice process or receive information about that process. That plan was adopted. The federal government approved of the work that we did in the first year, and we're here for a request to for authorization to expend the second year grant. We previously approached Assembly and received its approval to make the application. That application has been approved. In addition, we are seeking today approval to apply for the third year of the grant. And assuming that this body approved, we would anticipate making an application.
That's recommendation.
Mr. Chair, Kelly Friels again with the Department of Administrative Services. We are recommending approval of this request. In addition, there are two staff that currently work on the grant, and the FTE needs to be extended, so our recommendation is that you increase the office specialist to position by 0.33 FTE, or full-time equivalents, and the program analyst 3 by 0.44 full-time equivalent position.
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, member of the subcommittee, regardless of what our recommendation says in our write-up, we agree with BAM, that it should be an increase of 0.77 FTE. And the information came in, I changed it in the text and forgot to change it, the recommendation of the write-up. So it should be an increase of 0.77 FTE, which agrees with BAM's recommendation.
Okay. Are there any questions for any of the parties? Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move that we increase the federal funds expenditure limitation by $175,000 for the second year of the Crime Victims' Rights Compliance Project grant awarded by the U.S. Department of Justice, approve the submission of a federal grant application for the third year of the project later this biennium, and increase the FTE on two limited duration positions by 0.77.
It's been moved. Is there any additional discussion? Hearing none, are there any objections to the motion? Hearing none, motion passes. Senator Morris, will you carry? Item number 30, Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I do appear on item number 30, which is a request for your approval of our acceptance of $450,000 in federal grant funds to support the continued work of the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force with the unfortunate name of ICAC. ICAC is a very successful criminal law enforcement effort which is aimed at two kinds of criminal conduct that targets children. First, the unit investigates and provides prosecution support for child pornography offenses that are facilitated by Internet or online connections. And really, perhaps more accurately than child pornography, a more accurate description of that category of the ICAC's work would be that these are images of children being sexually abused. And that's the core of what's sometimes referred to as the child pornography portion of the caseload that's done by ICAC. The second category of offenses that ICAC has attacked involves efforts by offenders to entice or lure children to make physical contact and to then meet up with the defendant physically, and the unit has investigated and successfully helped prosecute cases of both categories. We previously sought and approved authorization from the Emergency Board to apply for the grant. We have now successfully applied for it, and we're asking for your approval for the necessary authority to receive it and expend it.
That's recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kelly Friels again. The grant amount is for $450,000, and that is for a full 24 months. The department plans on spending 18 months of the grant, so our recommendation is that you increase the federal fund expenditure limitation by $337,500. In addition, like the other grant, they have two positions that need to be extended. So our recommendation is that you increase the two existing criminal investigative positions that are limited duration from 12 months to 24 months, and that represents a 1.00 full-time equivalence.
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, we'll concur with BAM after some some good education efforts by Mr. Friels on the proper amount of the money. So we concur with the BAM recommendation.
Okay. Do we have any discussion? Do we have a motion? What's the proper amount?
$337,500. And the FTE increase is 1.0.
Will anyone move that?
Chair, I think I have this right. Increase federal fund expenditure limitation by $337,500 for the Internet Crimes Against Children grant awarded by the U.S. Department of Justice, and increase FTE by two limited duration positions to by one.
Any additional discussion? Any objections to the motion? Hearing none, motion passes.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Shepard, could you call my office tomorrow?
Certainly.
We would like to talk to you about an issue.
Be pleased to do so.
I will carry. We will recess now for just 5 minutes. 5 minutes only, and we'll come right back. Second, and we will go to item number 34, the Department of State Police.
Good morning.
Superintendent.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Ricker, Superintendent of the State Police. At the table is our BAM analyst, Linda Gilbert, and Mr. Ken Murphy, who is the Director of the Oregon Emergency Management Division of the Department. This request, as you are aware from our letter, pertains to a crisis communications and public outreach position for the Division of Oregon Emergency Management, and I would like to call upon Mr. Murphy to make the presentation to the committee.
Thank you, Superintendent. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Director of Oregon Emergency Management, and as the Superintendent stated, this is a request for a crisis communications and public education and an outreach position. In Oregon, we've had a past history of being very fortunate of not having huge disasters or many disasters. And as we move in the emergency management community to prepare plans, train, exercise, and equip, we do many good services for our citizens. One of the areas that we need to improve upon after you've done as much work as you possibly can is the point to educate, provide outreach to the citizens of our state and to the visitors of our state. As you well know, disasters may strike at any time in the state of Oregon, any time in any place, whether they're caused by natural forces or precipitated by actions of man. They clearly can take lives, destroy property, and know no boundaries. I think as we move through this, I want to clearly state that this is not about asking for a position, somebody to stand in front of a camera or a microphone. That is reserved for people such as myself and other officials of the state or other local jurisdictions. But what we need to try and do is take a hard look at how we address public education and outreach throughout the state, respective of each jurisdiction's hazards that they may have, whether it's wildfires, tsunamis, earthquakes, floods, droughts, and the list goes on to include terrorism. This public education is an ongoing, long-term thing. It's not something you just do once and walk away from it. It's something that we need to try and change the culture of how our citizens know of information, think of it, and what they can do to be better prepared. As we all know, in the public safety communities around the state and other agencies that have a role in disaster response and recovery, there's just not enough of any in one individual or organization to be able to help every citizen. So public education and awareness and outreach become a critical component. All of the latest White House, Senate, House, private industry reports over the last 20 years, even to include the most recent disaster of Hurricane Katrina, clearly has pointed out a theme that emerges each time, and that is the education of our citizens and visitors to our states. So I think it is as key as we go through this that public education and outreach become a very important part of what the state can do for its citizens and the visitors to our state. Another part of this request is to the creation of a crisis communications plan. That plan is built in such a manner and, again, is not a one-time event. It is something that is long-term and is constantly worked on. It also addresses what can be done prior to an event, during an event, and after an event to put together talking points, pre-scripted messaging to the media, different helpful tools to appointed and elected officials across the state at every level of government, to provide them information that they have and can use in the time of a crisis when there is chaos and people's lives and property are in danger. And this is just one more tool that can help them do a better job of helping the constituents in their area survive a disaster. And then finally, as part of the crisis communications plan, clearly putting together a good effort to work with the media in advance of a disaster where you have clear relationships and products set up where the media is part of our plan to help the citizens, inform them, potentially direct them where to go to get goods and services and make it part of messaging such as PSAs and those type of things, you know, to keep reminding our citizens of what they can do and how they can be better prepared. And I will just close that I continue to believe, you know, we will always work to better improve our preparedness in the state of Oregon, and I think this is a key component that will really help complete our plans in the state to where we can provide clear, concise, culturally competent messaging to all the citizens and those visitors that enjoy our state. If I have any questions, I'll conclude my testimony.
We will go on. Superintendent, did you have anything to offer?
Not directly, Mr. Chair, other than to comment that this is a partnership that extends far beyond the Division of Emergency Management, and the Oregon Military Department is our close partner in this endeavor, as of the remaining divisions of the state police and the rest of the public safety community within the state. So this will have a far-reaching, interactive relationship with a lot of players across the public safety spectrum.
Ms. Gilbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. Linda Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. Our recommendation is to approve your request of modification. First is to allocate $92,640 from the State Emergency Fund and establish one limited duration position, 0.46 full-time equivalent for Oregon Emergency Management, Crisis Communications, and Public Outreach. The second part of our recommendation requires a little more explanation, so I will give the recommendation first and the reason second. And that is, the recommendation is to increase federal funds expenditure limitation by $935,000 for the Information Management Division's work on criminal history data integrity. The explanation for this is that after the deadline for agencies to submit letters to the emergency board requesting specific items, it became apparent that the agency would need additional federal funds limitation in order to fund or to expend existing grant resources from National Criminal History Improvement Project funds. And this is due to two things happened. There was a larger beginning balance than was anticipated, and the limitation that the legislature provided during the session was less than what they actually had to spend, and that was because at the time it was not known how much there would be to spend. So the recommendation, in order to be able to expend funds, some of them expire fairly quickly, so in order to be able to expend them, the recommendation is to increase the federal funds expenditure limitation by $935,000.
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, our recommendation is slightly different. I'll address the items that Ms. Gilbert detailed first, the second part of that. We agree with almost everything that Ms. Gilbert said, except that the actual shortfall in the federal funds limitation is $932,639, slightly different, and that would be our recommendation for the increase in the federal funds. We agree with what reasons Ms. Gilbert pointed out for the need of that expenditure limitation. To the original request, our recommendation is that you allocate $90,000 for the development of the Coordinated Crisis Communications Plan. There were numerous discussions around this, including with the Chief of Staff for the Governor, and through those conversations, the preparation of the Crisis Communications Plan was verified and seemed to be the most immediate need. The Office of Emergency Management does have what I think Mr. Murphy termed as an outline, or is that my term? I'm not sure, of a crisis communications plan as part of the larger emergency management plan, but there has to be a lot more detail put on it, and I think Mr. Murphy outlined those. We will leave it up to the agency to determine the best way to prepare that plan, but that should be the primary use of the $90,000. They can either hire a consultant that may have done this for another state or another jurisdiction, or if so wish, they can go to DAS and get an authority for a limited duration position for the remainder of the biennium. Whatever route is taken, we would like, or we're recommending that the agency return to the next session, to the appropriate policy committee, whatever that might be next session, as well as part of the budget process, submit or detail that plan out so the legislature understands what it is and can use that as a basis for deciding what the long-term resource needs are in this area. If there is additional funding from that $90,000, we're recommending at that time it can be used for the education outreach. We understand that's important, but from our discussions, as I noted, it appeared that the crisis communications plan was the most important thing to develop at this time. So, again, our recommendation is allocate $90,000 for this request, as well as the expenditure limitation in the federal funds area of $932,639.
For the committee, my discussions with some of the parties would be that while they might prefer the DAS recommendation, they can live with the LFO recommendation. Is that an accurate statement?
Mr. Chair, I can live with it, and I do concur with Mr. Wilson. We can provide a fair amount of information by the time that the legislative session begins, but it really does take a lot longer to put together a concrete plan. And I still, if approved, want to work on public education and outreach, because I still think, both products, it's hard to determine and say what's more important. But I guess I would defer to the importance of making sure that our citizens are given every opportunity to be better prepared.
Senator Morse, did you have
another question here?
Yes, Representative Scott.
So if you agree with LFO, how are you going to spend the $90,000?
Chair Devlin, Representative Scott, my preference is to hire a limited duration position. My experience with hiring a contractor, this is not a product that can be brought and put together in a one-time effort. It's something that is developed over a long period of time, literally working with each community in the state, state agencies, and the state as a whole to put together different portions of it, of messaging prior to any type of event that may affect Oregon, during the event and after the event, and then being able to adjust it into different languages, culturally competent additionally. So my preference is that we work with an actual full-time employee, that can sustain this and adjust it based upon the needs of our state and our communities.
So if we assume that, and we assume that DAS's calculations are correct, and that 11-month salary and benefits is going to equal $68,240, let's just assume that, what's the additional $22,760 going to
be? Chair Devlin, Representative Scott, most of that is some travel and supplies and services to be able to, our anticipated use of that was to be able to put together public education material. I have a very grave concern that we try and accomplish those things quickly, to start providing more information to our citizens around that, and to take care of those type of products, work with PSAs and the media, to begin putting these type of things into everyone's daily lives.
Ready for motion?
Yes.
We have an additional recommendation by staff that was not included in the write-up, and whether it's appropriate to put it in the motion or not, I don't know, but that is to
a request to have them return for the long-term plan in the 07 session. Would you like that in the motion?
Yes. And understanding that that may not be an entirely completed plan at that point. I mean, it's, I think that was your indication that it may take you longer to get a completed project. But.
Well, with that, Mr. Chair, I would move that we allocate $90,000 from the emergency fund for the development of a coordinated crisis communications plan for responses to major incidents or disasters, increase the federal funds expenditure limitation by $932,639 for federal grant funds to be received from the U.S. Department of Justice, or which have been received since 2000, and that the department returned to the 07 session with a long-term plan.
Is there any additional discussion? Any objections to the motion? Hearing none, motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Morris. Military Department, items 31 and 32. We will go to item 32. I guess it's General Caldwell now.
Yes, sir.
Correct. Well, congratulations. How long has it been? About 6 months.
No, sir. Not quite that long. It's been 960, getting on 90 days.
Oh, okay. Well, congratulations, General.
Please start. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell with the Reagan National Guard, Deputy Director. We're requesting, we have two items before you today, requesting approval for a sale exchange of 1.9 acres of land at the Medford Armory and seeking the establishment of a capital construction and other funds expenditure limitation for $907,000. Our intent is to take advantage of an opportunity to complete much-needed improvements in the Medford Armory and the maintenance shop that sits right behind it.
General Caldwell,
yes, sir.
I'm just so used to saying Colonel. It's going to take a little while.
Okay.
Can we start with 32? I thought we'd do the easy one first.
You want to do the easy one first? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we're requesting the establishment of a capital construction and other funds limitation in the amount of $342,000 for construction of various site improvements at the Baker City Readiness Center. We completed construction of the Baker City Armory and Readiness Center and received a conditional certificate of occupancy. The condition placed on the certificate of occupancy requires us to construct an additional vehicle parking facility on a portion of the site that currently has an extension building on it being used by Baker County. The Baker County Fair Board has a long-term lease of the facility with the Oregon State University Extension Service and can't vacate the building until September of 2006. Existing capital construction other fund limitation expires August 1st, 2006, and the Emergency Board cannot extend the limitation as the expiration dates. So we seek new limitation to complete the required site improvements, and we have sufficient cash on hand to complete the work. So that concludes my testimony on the Baker City. Pleased to answer any questions.
Staff's recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Linda Gilbert Daz recommends that the subcommittee approve the request.
Mr. Feister.
LFO recommends that the subcommittee approve the request with the understanding that the Department of Administrative Services unschedule the remaining $2,000 biennium other funds capital construction limitation, which should be at least $340,000. The LFO recommendation differs from the department's and the budget management write-up in two ways. This unscheduling of the limitation, and also we would like to note that if the capital construction limitation is approved by the emergency board, it will expire at the end of the current biennium.
General Caldwell, Ms. Gilbert, do you have any comments? Or
no, we can live with that.
Any questions from the committee? Okay. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move the LFO recommendation to approve the request with the instructions that the funds be on schedule.
Okay. Any additional discussion? Hearing none, any objections to the motion? Hearing no objections, motion passes. Now we will go on to item 31. Before we start on item 31, I just want to state for the record that there is a difference between the DAS and the LFO recommendation. I think all parties are here today to actually do the state's business and do it to the best of their ability. This is a democratic process, so we're going to have a democratic discussion of the merits of both proposals, and then we will ultimately decide.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for that introduction. Again, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Marine Military Department. And as I said earlier, and again, we're requesting approval of a sale or exchange of 1.9 acres of land at the Medford Armory, seeking the establishment of a capital construction other funds expenditure limitation of $907,000. Our intent is to take advantage of the opportunity to complete much-needed improvements and neglected improvements to the Medford Armory and its maintenance shop. In the 1950s, we received title to 7.65 acres in the city of Medford from Jackson County to be used to develop the Medford Armory maintenance shop. While we retained the title of this property, a condition of its transfer originally to the agency was a reversion clause, essentially requiring the agency to transfer the property back to the county when it's no longer needed for military purposes. We were approached by the county and began negotiations to exchange 1.9 acres of the property for 0.45 acres and some cash. Under the plan, Walmart, who is developing a store adjacent to the armory, seeks 1.9 acres for parking use and will provide 0.45 acres adjacent to the northeast corner of the property and pay $850,000 for that. There was a map attached to the original letter, and I'm sure you must have it in your file. In the VAS analysis, you will see that the schedule of work is listed. However, our legislative fiscal recommended $57,000 be unscheduled and basically taken out of the project. We disagree with LFO on this proposal, and we believe that the E-Board should take the LFO or the DAS proposal. Otherwise, we essentially start out with less money available to complete the project. If you look at also one of the attachments that came from probably in your list, and I think Mr. Borden maybe he did provide the same thing. There's a list of items 1 through 7 that we estimated on the remodels. If you take $57,000 out, then I would say that the most obvious ones, and you'll also note that contingency is $39,000. So you'll also note that if you take that $57,000 out, more than likely, the restrooms, facility, shop upgrades would be the easiest. That pretty much covers those two. We would pull those out of the project. I might also add that several years ago, almost 20 years ago, I think it was, we did an upgrade to the armory and added offices in the front of it. Part of the agreement with the city at the time was that we would pave the parking lot, which has never been paved. It's a gravel parking lot. We made a caveat that we had to get legislative approval. Go back and look at every budget that we've had since that time, you'll find that there's a request in there for a project to pave that parking lot. We've never done it. That's been 20 years. The city's not very happy with us about that, and they've not been very happy. So this was part of this negotiation process over a 20-year period that we've been avoiding that cost, and now they say, now you've got a way to fix it, and we'll help you. So that's kind of some of the detail behind all of why we scheduled the project the way we scheduled it. The other thing I would add is that this armory is one of our most productive armories with respect to revenue. It may be the top one it was for a number of years, but it competed favorably with the Salem Armory until the fair built their new building, which dilapidated our rental income from the Salem Armory. I think any improvement that we do down there, whether it be parking lot, restrooms, or whatever we do, HVAC, which is what we've got planned here, will increase our revenue. And I think that increase in revenue is ultimately going to benefit the other armories, because I don't see the day in the state of Oregon where we're going to have enough resources to adequately do what we need to do to the 39, 40 armories that we own. I think it's just a reality, and we're going to keep patching them together and keeping them up. So anything we can do to increase revenue on the ones that will rent and earn revenue, I think it's in our best interest to do that for the long term. That concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Ms. Gilbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Linda Gilbert, DAS Budget and Management. We recommend that the subcommittee approve the request for $907,000.
Legislative Fiscal Office recommends approval of the sale of 1.9 acres of State of Oregon Real Property in Medford to the Walmart Corporation at compensation level commensurate with the property's market value, and that there be established another funds capital construction expenditure limitation of $850,000 for the military department for the Medford Armory and Maintenance Facility, with the understanding that the Department of Administrative Services will unschedule the limitation less actual cost of architectural and in the engineering contract pending the award of the final construction contract. The LFO recommendation differs from the department's request and the budget management recommendation on four primary points. One is the limitation financing of the project. LFO recommends that limitation only be granted up to the amount of the Walmart payment and is not recommending the $57,000 in capital construction account funding be used. That the recommendation that the limitation be unscheduled is also another point where we differ. It's important to note that in the LFO analysis, there's discussion of the Department of Administrative Services Capital Projects Advisory Board approval, and that was received by the department on June 15th, last Friday. The third item where we differ is that, and it's similar to the Baker City project, and that is that the capital construction limitation, if approved by the emergency board, will expire at the end of the biennium. And the fourth point is more of a note of clarification, and that is that it's LFO's understanding that the payment will be received directly by the department from the Walmart Corporation, as opposed to, I think, in the budget and management analysis, it has the payment going first to the county and then on to the department. So just to clarify those four points, I would be happy to offer more specific elaboration, if you so desire, on the limitation and financing issue.
Do we have any discussion?
Does this request create a real problem in the capital construction account in exceeding the authority that has previously been approved?
Senator Devlin and Chair Devlin and Senator Morris, by authority, it would be probably more appropriate to say cash balance. Right now, the department has outlined some general commitments against the capital construction account that are approximately $1.6 million, and the cash balance of that current fund is $1.1 million. This Medford project of $57,000 was the last item on the list of that $1.6 million general commitments that the department has outlined.
General Caldwell, do you have a response?
Mr. Chairman, your staff is correct. It's a moving target. I think that's one of the issues that when we attribute project dollars from the Capital Construction Fund, in effect earmark them, we're betting on the come that the federal government is going to approve some projects and we'll need some money to match those. That doesn't always flow, and it's not as simple as saying you've got 1.6 million, 10 projects, and they all show up in order, because that just simply doesn't operate that way. The feds have their mystical way of doing things, and sometimes they come early, sometimes they come late, sometimes they don't come at all. I think the practice has been, whether it's the best business practice or not, I'm not going to argue that before anybody, but our practice has been is when targets of opportunity present themselves, whether they be a congressional ad or there's some other mystical way the feds show up with money to build something, is that we take care of that target of opportunity. Now, ultimately, there's no question, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and try to fool you that there won't be a request for some general fund money somewhere along the way, because when you have $1.6 million worth of potential projects, and $1.1 million in that account, there's going to be a request for some general fund resources. Or perhaps we will sell some other property or something else will come along, another target of opportunity. So, like I said, it's I'm not denying that that's accurate analysis, but it doesn't quite work that way in reality because of the timing. I hope that gives you some idea of how we operate and work, but that's simply what this one is about, is that this is a target that's showed up early as opposed to one that may not show up for another year, 2 years, or maybe never at all.
Question, please.
Yes.
Go through the capitalization account, construction account again, please. With the, is the proposed sale of the 850 to Walmart, that included in the funds or in the capital construction?
Chair Devlin.
It'd be new money, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would be new money. It's not in the account now. The military department needs to first receive approval for the sale, and then they have classified it that the payment from Walmart is imminent.
So if they we approve the sale and they receive the cash, what will the balance be?
It will be the approximately $2.4 million.
And how much?
Approximately $1.9 million with $2.4 million of commitment.
Okay. And clarification here, the sale, the 850, they still need approval to take the 57 from the board from their capital account, right?
The Chair Devlin, the way the approval would work would be through the limitation.
Yeah.
The limitation is granted.
They need the limitation increase to be able to use the 57. If we approve the LFO recommendation, what it basically comes down to is they have the 850. Some items they have immediately. Other items, when they actually let the bids out, they can utilize the remainder of the 850, but they would still not have the 57 unless they got the additional limitation.
Chair Devlin, that's correct. Nothing would preclude the bid from coming in under, or preclude the department from coming back if they needed additional limitation if other resources were identified, such as interest earnings on the $850,000.
Okay. But they would actually need approval to actually expend the interest earnings in terms of an additional limitation on the expenditure.
Yes.
Yeah. Chairs don't traditionally make motions, so this chair will not. but one way that this could be approached is to approve a portion of the LFO recommendation that has to do with the unscheduling, and to approve the DAS recommendation with the overall limitation, which is the 907. And I'll turn it over to Senator Morse.
Thank you. Have you executed an earnest money agreement with Walmart?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morse, we have been in negotiations with, to answer your question directly, no, sir, we have not. We've got a contract that is being back and forth between DOJ, us, and the parties. We're about ready to sign it. DOJ's approved it. We need this approval before we can execute.
Yeah.
So we have not received any money from them.
They have to have the approval of the state before they can actually.
Well, it would seem to me a pretty simple solution here would be to sell the property for $907,000.
Mr. Chairman, that might be the best way around this whole mess. Yeah. I would, Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, I would say that, like I said, this has been going on for about a year. I think, based on the appraisals and what we understand about it, I think we're getting probably at the top of the market right now. for that sliver of land. And I don't know if you saw the diagram in your read-aheads, but it's on the back page, and either pass it around. You can.
Well, they have it. They
got it.
Okay.
You can see that it's a sliver of property that kind of runs, you know, north and south, or I guess it's east and west. But the advantage that we have with this whole thing is that we'll actually get multiple use of both parking lots. They'll be on a level plane, too. So I think, from a practical standpoint, I think we're about as far as we can go with them as far as pushing them.
Follow-up to, if I may, to Senator Morris, has Walmart built?
Mr. Chairman, no.
And so don't they need the land?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scott, indeed. This is part of the whole package. There were other issues that Walmart, kind of give you the whole scenario, is that as always when these things start out, of course, it's got to be done tomorrow, and it's a quick deal. And then all of a sudden things came to a grinding halt. We didn't hear from them for a long period of time. And then all of a sudden they're back again, and it looked like we had, again, we were in full engagement. Got the lawyers talking, got the paperwork working to make sure they all agreed with what was in the legal terms. And the county kind of stepped out because about that time the city stepped into the Walmart, and apparently their systems development charges were over and above what Walmart wanted, so they were going to pull the plug and not do anything. So then it went dormant again for another 3 or 4 months, and then just in the last 60 days, I would say that it came back up on the screen. It looks like they're moving forward, and they've resolved their problems with the city. So I think, with all these different parties, it's been one of these negotiations that seems to never quite have a beginning or an end. It's just been a strange deal. But we're as close now as we've ever been to concluding it. From what I understand, they've resolved those issues. They were pushing us to get the contract. We said we can't do that until we have authority from the E-Board, which we weren't going to come to you beforehand because it was on again, off again. So that was one of our issues that we were looking at. Now I'd say it's about a 95% sure thing that's going to happen.
Mr. Chair, looking at this from a business perspective, we don't know what the market is until they say no. And with that in mind, it would seem to me it might be appropriate for us to authorize the sale of 1.9 acres for $907,000 and bring this subject back to the September E-Board with a specific plan, which gives us the opportunity to be reactive in hopefully an appropriate way. We're just talking out loud here.
Senator Morris, the only issue I would have, and this is my own personal issue, is although I have a schematic of the Walmart plan, I do not know if they have alternative sites around it to meet whatever requirements they have to meet for parking. So the National Guard could find themselves without a buyer if they have another alternative to meet it. And we could find ourselves also with a way without no dollars to actually improve the armory that probably is in significant need of improvement, if that would be the case.
So let's explore that. Do they have other options?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scott, I can't tell you one way or the other. I've not been personally involved in all of the negotiations. I kind of get the report after the fact, and from what I understand, they've been interested in this site for over a year now. So to say that it's still moving along on that plane would lead me to believe, based on where our armory is sitting in the city of Medford, that's a pretty desirable site. There's two major thoroughfares. It's almost on a, if I can give you kind of an example, you're probably familiar, most of you are, with Newburgh and how you split off and you have one way going one way and another way coming the other way. We're sitting right on that split. And then adjacent to that is an interchange to I-5 to go to Ashland. So it's on the south end of town. So I would say it's a fairly desirable site. We even explored it one time, to be real candid about it. We explored with the county. of selling the whole thing and moving to another site, just to bail out. The issue goes back to, one, we put a lot of investment in this facility with respect to its initial build and also the remodel, and the fact that it earns a tremendous amount of money each year for our other funds necessities, which we migrate out of that facility to other facilities such as Burns or Cottage Grove or places that don't earn a penny. So from our standpoint, we've elected not to look at that moving further out and finding a cheaper piece of property and getting a one-time profit. We think the long term is better.
Well, you're not much more, Mr. Chair. You're not much more than $10 a square foot. prime commercial property certainly go for more than $10 a square foot.
I kind of like your approach. However, even with that, I'm not certain that just because we have the cash that we should authorize, if Walmart pays the $907, I'm not sure that we should just authorize that. You follow what I'm saying, that if LFO is correct and we can do it for $850, I'm not sure that we should just authorize it. I'm okay with the sale for $907. And then I kind of like what the chair has said about both halves of it and having them come back after we, so to speak, get the bids. That makes sense?
General Caldwell.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we'll do whatever this committee desires, and I'm not certainly going to sit here and tell you that it's either all or nothing. I have a staff of probably 25 people that do this every day, that estimate projects, execute projects, construct things. LFO has one budget analyst. If you're suggesting that LFO has a better understanding of what this project's going to cost and what it's going to do than my staff does, then I would vehemently disagree with that ability. I think we have given this project everything we can possibly give it with respect to its due diligence to come up with the best numbers. And I, $57,000, because it came out of the other fund, where did it come from? I mean, we ask these questions during the discussion. It simply comes out of the other fund. That's the reason. And if we want to sell this property and not do the project in Medford and take that $907,000 total and go out and do other Army projects, God knows we got them. I'm willing to do that, too, if that's what this committee wants and that's what the legislature desires. Because we have a tremendous number. We got millions of dollars worth of projects out there that we can do that desperately need work in other armories. So I think that's really the decision here, is whether or not we're going to improve this armory or we're not. And we'll do whatever this committee and the legislature directs.
I don't think that's what we were saying, or at least what I was trying to say. Maybe I didn't say it correctly, but that's not what I was trying to say. What I was suggesting was, based upon, and I appreciate that you have a staff of 25 or whatever the number is, and if they come up with these numbers, but what I'm suggesting, knowing the construction business, they won't come out as even numbers as this shows here.
Absolutely correct.
So what I'm suggesting is that maybe once you have those final bids, it may even be higher.
Could be. Yeah, we'll
but you could come back to us at that point and say, I need the $57,000 or whatever the number is, and that we have the $57,000 in a sale, so it makes it much more comfortable. And that's all that I'm trying to suggest. And I think, if I'm reading between the lines, that's kind of what LFO is saying, if those numbers change. But I don't think that any of the three of us are sitting up here saying, no, we don't want you to do the project, or that, you know, we rely and acknowledge your expertise and the department's expertise and that this is where it should go and that you'll generate some funds after it's done and all that sort of stuff. So I don't think we're trying to say that. We're just also trying, what I'm trying to say is that we keep it at whatever level it's at, but we get real numbers when we make the allocation for it.
Mr. Chairman, I would just, if that was the approach, then what we would do is we put the project together and put it out on the street. We would do calling out alts, additions, alternatives in the bid process. Probably that would be the way to approach it. And like I said, the two most obvious things that I would put as adults is the restroom restoration and some things that are packaged deals. So if you lose something, you know, you don't screw up the whole project, you know what I mean? The major items in this is the parking lot and the HVAC.
I don't know that we're saying that we'll lose anything. It's just that we will. I'd like to see a schedule is based upon real numbers versus...
And we can do that. Yes, sir, we can do that.
Well, I'd like to see.
What I might suggest in this, and my understanding, and Mr. Borden can speak up, is that his recommendation was not entirely based on an evaluation of the cost estimate. It was based on the fact that there was $850,000 available, and then that we had approximately $1.6 million in a capital fund, and that this particular this particular project, when ranked in that capital fund in previous budget, ranked low in that capital fund. So that's why I would believe you did not include the $57,000, because it ranked lower. What I might suggest here is just one question, General Caldwell. If we give you approval for the sale, we go along with the LFO recommendation, the $850,000. Can you meet the completion date by the end of this coming fiscal year, which is another portion of the portion of the reality, because they're saying it has to be completed?
It's, Mr. Chairman, to answer your question, it's going to be difficult. We got to get an architect.
Okay.
It's going to take time. There's going to be, I would like to think that we could get something on the street within the next 12 months before the new biennium starts. This is, you know, this is what we got on the street. Whether it has the additions, alterations to it or not is how we bid everything anyway. With today's construction prices, we always do a bid that way because we never really know what's going to come out with bids.
Can I suggest, because I don't seem to have consensus, and I have to have absolute consensus on this three-member committee to pass anything, that we approve LFO's recommendation with one caveat. We ask you to come back, should your bids exceed that, and ask for an additional limitation to this committee. I'm pretty sure it would be assigned to this committee. It probably would be our maybe September, but more likely we have a December meeting.
November.
Yeah. That you come back to one of the other meetings if you need additional authorization.
We'll certainly have a better picture by then.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I would seriously question. Here we are nearing the 1st of July, and we haven't selected an architect. And to go through all of that process and to actually have it advertised and for bids while we're in the interim, I think would be a very aggressive order. And may not be practical, and I see the general concurring with that. This may be an issue where we approve the sale of the land and an expedited planning process, and then come back into regular session and approve the actual construction, unless you're sensing the urgency to actually, you know, cast this thing off and go with it now.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, we've been doing design-build projects to try to cut some of that time frame down. this project may lend itself very nicely to that because of its scope and its size. It's rather small. And I think that's the direction we were planning on in this project, to eliminate some of that long-term period. Nevertheless, even to get to that stage of the game, it will be November before we can, at the earliest, before we can really give you hard, cold numbers. I think that's just a reality.
How would you react to the LFO recommendation with an understanding that we might have we would have an expectation that if possible, you would come back to this committee? The issue you're going to have during session is you will have one bill. and may work out well. I mean, there may not be really a problem, but you will have one bill that will cover the capital construction projects, and that might pass in May, and that might pass in August, maybe even April. I'll give you an optimist.
I think, Mr. Chairman, you're correct. We would prefer to deal with the emergency board on this. That way it does not get tied up in that in that situation where we are August, because I think it's happened before, and that would really, really be a detriment to what we want to get done there.
Mr. Chairman, could we come back to the price of the land again? We're at risk of micromanaging your operations, gentlemen, and I recognize that. But I do know that the market for Walmart locations is not unlimited. In most communities, they're not even welcome. It's a huge battle. If they've already crossed that threshold and it's a site that the city is approving, it becomes a premium site. And if there's any way that you can move that price up, we need to be exploring that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, I will personally get involved with that, and I will turn the screws as tight as I can. How's that?
Can you tell them if they don't go to 900 that your
I may make
that
it
your members will lose their restrooms and their locker rooms?
I may tell them to come up with 950 or a million or the deal's done. I don't know. But I will personally get involved in that and see if we can't do a better job.
Being a good corporate citizen and neighbor that Walmart is, I'm certain that they will want to elevate that based upon the feasibility of the guard losing their restrooms and facility shop upgrades.
Okay.
Good recommendation.
Do we have a motion?
Here's where I'm concerned is that if we approve a sale of the land at 1.9 at a specific price, that is the price.
Well, I think we have a way of doing it. How about if we approve the sale of the 1.9 acres of the State of Oregon real property in Medford to the Walmart Corporation at a compensation level commensurate to the property's market value, and establish other fund capital constructions expenditure limitation of $850 for the Oregon Military Department for the Medford Armory and maintenance facilities, with the understanding that the Department of Administrative Services will unschedule the limitation less than the actual cost of the architecture and engineering contract pending the awarding of the construction contract.
And within that, Representative Scott, is there an understanding that if Colonel Caldwell is faced with the situation of having to cut items from the project, that he can bring those back for additional limitation for the E-Board's ultimate decision?
Absolutely.
Okay. That's the motion. Do we have any additional discussion?
Thank you. That's a good motion.
Got it. Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, motion passes.
Thank you very much.
Let's see. Representative Morse, will you carry Baker City and, or Senator Morse, I'm sorry. It's an elevation to call him the representative. Senator Morse, will you carry the Baker City? And Representative Scott, will you carry the Medford?
Sure.
Okay. We will go on to the Department of Transportation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Matthew Garrett. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and it is my pleasure and I'm pleased to be here to continue our conversation about cash management. This is an issue that is fundamental to my agency's success, and this is our second appearance before the E-Board as prescribed by the budget note. And I want to kind of step away from the script here and say this. While the direction came in a budget note, I want you to know personally, as director, this is an important issue to me. I think this is about the confidence in my agency to deliver on the investments that we've been given. So this is something that I understand the gravity and the sensitivity of the issue. So I look forward to this conversation and, again, culminating the direction coming from the budget note, an additional chat. Our last conversation before the board, you accepted the report, but you requested four additional issues to be addressed and to come back during this June e-board meet. Those four issues were a description of how strategies presented in January are being used to develop our 07-09 budget request. The second issue was an analysis of the design-build projects, how they're accelerating project delivery. Let me just quickly remind you, design-build is an innovative contracting tool. It differs from the traditional approach of design-bid-build. Literally, it's allowing a contractor to do the design and construction at the same time. You really migrate from a sequential set of exercises under design-bid-build to a concurrent conversation where actually the design and the construction can take place at the same time. The third issue to be addressed is a list of delayed or canceled projects. What happens to the funds that are attached to those type projects, and is there any implications to projects of statewide significance? And again, just a reminder, projects of statewide significance was a list that was identified several years ago by our Transportation Commission. 8 projects throughout the state of Oregon, 5 residing up in the Portland metro area, and 3 scattered through the Willamette Valley down into southern Oregon. These are projects with substantial price tags, some into the $1 billion, the Columbia River Crossing being one in the Portland metro area, others hovering about the $500 million mark, Newburgh-Dundee, $400 million or so. So big, complex projects that the traditional revenue stream just cannot fund. So there was a list identified by the Oregon Transportation Commission. And the final issue broached was a description and articulation of what the development skip for the 2008-2011 program, how does this differ from previous development steps? So with that, I thought, gentlemen, I would just very quickly go through the 4 points to address those issues. Again, specific to the strategies used, the key strategy that we're employing here is a much more nimble and aggressive analysis of the expenditures and revenues that come into the agency. We would defer the conversation until the next step update. So as we were looking at the financial ebb and flow of monies coming into and out of the organization, that was a 2-year snapshot. We now monitor that activity on a monthly basis, and we update and we'll perform a full revenue and expenditure analysis every 6 months. So we have a much more aggressive but much more nimble understanding of the way projects flow in and out and are delivered, the schedule of that, as well as the revenues that flow into our budget. That is a key strategy that we've employed. We think that better informs the discussion. We'll have a better handle on our forecast and on the deliverables as they play themselves out in our project list going into the 07-09 budget. So a very useful tool, critical tool that we're now employing and will continue to implement. The second question with regard to design-build projects, are they accelerating delivery? As I've said, we move from the traditional approach where we have a design firm that develops a project, a set of plans for a project. We take that and then we bid it out, and then a construction firm takes it on and eventually delivers the program. A very sequential pace, a traditional approach that served the state of Oregon very well. But that said, in order for us to deliver and execute and implement and deliver projects at a faster pace, we've engaged in conversations with our business partners on new approaches for project delivery, design build. 2 things are happening. It's critical that we continue to look at these innovative type of delivery methods. Again, it allows us to deliver sooner, and I think we've articulated in the materials before you that we're seeing with those projects we have on the ground right now about a year advancement in terms of time, which means more money is inserted and infused into the state's economy sooner as those projects play themselves out to the final day we're clipping a ribbon and people are traveling on the project.
several questions are playing themselves out. This is a new area. It's new to us. I think it's new to our business partners, to some extent with the Association of General Contractors. Again, this is somewhat of a strategic tool in the sense that not all projects are designed for a design build. There are certain characteristics that would tell you this is not a good candidate for design build. Those are projects that have extensive right-of-way type issues or public outreach. You have to engage the community to get a better understanding of the vision of their transportation solution as they see it, incorporate that with our engineering transportation solution as well. There are, if indeed a project should have environmental, cultural, resource type issues, those don't lend themselves well. Those are extending out timelines. And again, the effort with design build is to move very quickly and crisply in delivering the project as you're allowing one contractor to move this thing through as they're designing and constructing. So we're working with our business partners at AGC to make sure that we're creating the appropriate environment, a healthy business environment, so we can grow design build. We're right on the cusp. We want to make sure that the size of the project, some concern has been raised on the size of the projects. Do Oregon firms have the appropriate roster, so to speak, to engage at that level? Those are healthy, robust business conversations we're having with our partners there in an effort, again, to make sure we have the healthiest environment to grow this innovative project delivery tool. As I said before, we also apply scrutiny on the types of projects that we would use this mechanism for, because not all lend themselves to the design build. Again, I spoke to the pace, how we can advance things. We're seeing things play themselves out with certain design build projects about a year in advance in terms of timing and delivery. I think we need more time to truly see the benefits of this program as we continue to work with our business partners to grow the environment and the opportunities, as well as to see how it plays itself out in the real world. But we see it as an exciting opportunity that this agency will embrace and aggressively pursue. The third issue to speak to you today is what happens when a project is delayed, a project is canceled. Where does the money go? Can some of that money flow to projects of statewide significance, as we spoke about a little bit earlier? I want to tell you that ODOT does not reallocate monies that are attached to a project that would be deferred. But we want to make sure that just because there's a hitch in the get-along, so to speak, there may be an environmental reason, there may be a political reason as to why we need to defer the timeline that we originally had set forth. We certainly don't want to lose a project that we believe has merit by taking the money. So the money stays with the project, so to speak.
In essence, are you talking about utilizing what cash flow that you have?
I think that's right. We're seeing what's available. It plays itself out with deferred projects. We keep the money with the project. With canceled projects, it opens up an opportunity maybe to come back, reinvest in projects that may have some financial liability to them with costs that have increased for a variety of external reasons. We may have a new solution that's been developed that's ready to go and you can invest in that. We may have emergencies that play themselves out as well. So with a little bit difference between deferred projects, the money stays with it. Canceled projects, we have a much more flexible option before us to insert that, whether it's on the cost offset, a new project, or some type of emergency. Now, specific to statewide significant projects, if we're talking the major modernization funds that we have, those capacity funds, those funds are allocated on a regional equity basis, and we try to maintain that. So just because, say, a project up in the Portland metro area falls by the wayside, we want to keep it, specifically the modernization monies, up in the Portland metro area to make sure we maintain that regional equity that is foundational to our modernization conversation. I would argue, if you look at the cost, as I mentioned earlier, on the projects of statewide significance, the monies that we would see on most projects that would be canceled can't feed the appetite. It may, in some very small incremental fashion, go into it. A region could make the decision in a conversation with an Area Commission on Transportation, or in the Portland metro area, the Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation, JPAC. As you said around those forums, where would you send these monies? A decision could be made to send it to a project of statewide significance, but let's not be under any impression they would fully fund or even come close to those type of projects. Those are, again, very costly projects that we continue to move forward in increments, try to make major milestones, whether it's the purchase of right-of-way preliminary engineering. We're trying to prep those projects and get them to a state of readiness, much like we did with the Pioneer Mountain Eddyville project on US 20, where over the last 20-some years we had been investing in that project, which has a price tag of about $130 million. We had readied it through those various milestones. The OTIA spike investment came. We stood ready to move that forward toward construction. Literally, that is the conversation that's playing itself out with statewide significant projects. Again, one of the, and this is a little bit off the issue today, but it's important because one of the projects of statewide significance, the Newburgh-Dundee Transportation Solution or Bypass, is a project that stands on that statewide significant list, and we're also looking at an innovative funding mechanism there through the public-private partnership. Again, engaging with our friends from the Macquarie Investment Group to see if it's technically and financially feasible to fund that project via tolls. So the conversation that truly plays itself out the end of summer, early fall, we'll be better informed on the technical, on the financial, and on the third and probably major point of where the public is.
Every time he says tolls, I get three emails.
I do too. So, but the bottom line is, I would say the migration of a project, a cancellation of a project, can add to, but in no way will fully fund a project of statewide significance. The fourth and final issue that was raised at our last conversation dealt with the need to better articulate what the development step looks like in the 2008-2011 time frame here. Have to go back into the future, and I'm just going to shoot very frank with you. We did have a development skip years ago, and I think it was nothing more than a document that allowed folks to make politically expedient decisions. If I was having a conversation with the chairman years ago and he had a project that he wanted on the list, I said, "Chairman, I can take care of you, sir. I'll put you on my development list." What happened was, for all intents and purposes, the growth of an undisciplined list that became nothing more than a laundry list of a wish list of projects that, again, the financial mechanisms could never get to, would take forever. But it was politically expedient for me to tell the chairman that I could put you on the list. We've changed that. That wasn't very productive. That raises expectations, and that's a double-edged sword, to be very honest with you. I want my agency to be known. If I tell you something, I'm shooting straight with you. If I tell you one, you're on a list. That list has substance and significance. It's just not something that's easy for me to do to get out of a conversation or to get out of a room. So our commission has brought more discipline to the development step. Come 2008-11, we have put certain criteria. The investments in these type of projects need to make sure that the projects are moving to those major milestones, be they the preliminary planning type process, be they an environmental impact statement or an environmental assessment of a project, be it design work. Everything that moves from concept to planning to development that puts us right on the cusp of construction. And there's the migration between the development strip and the construction strip. The construction strip's that four-year fiscally constrained document that shows you the glide path and the times and the types of money that are going to be invested in the transportation solution throughout the state of Oregon. The development strip is a preparatory area. We are doing the spade work that preps those projects to be ready for construction when monies flow, either through the normal allocations or through funding packages that play themselves out in legislative sessions. So the bottom line is that's the difference. We now have criteria, we have discipline associated with the developmental step. And we have money specifically allocated for the developmental stip. I think the commission has allocated $5 million, and literally that, if you just do math, $5 million allows us to do about $50 million of preparatory work. The preliminary investment's about 10% of the construction costs. So you can see that investment yields dividends. We start to prep and ready those projects to take advantage of funding flows or funding spikes as they come. So, Mr. Chairman, those are the four issues that we were asked to come back, continue our conversation. I have, again, shared with you how important this issue is to me as the director of the agency. I will make the commitment that I will be in this chair sharing the conversations of how this cash management issue is playing itself out, not only during the interim, but obviously during the legislative session itself. This is important to me. Again, as I said, this is the underpinning, as I see it, of confidence in my agency that we are a good investment, we are a good steward of taxpayers' money. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my report, and it's my hope that you'll accept this report.
Questions?
Two questions, Mr. Chair. Thank you for appearing today. The goal of an ending fund balance of $100 million, was that set by the department or was that set by the legislature?
I think both. I guess it's our.
You own that.
Yeah, we own that. We think it's the appropriate cushion, just in case something goes bad. Mother Nature deals us a blow. We have a cushion that we can react to, rather than getting into negative numbers and having to borrow. So, I guess the reason I said it was both of us is I've had the privilege of working with Ms. Jordan trying to articulate why we arrived at that. That cushion. We think it's a good business decision. We think it's an appropriate cushion, and we'll continue to push right down to that line. But it's a business decision my agency has made.
Then the follow-up would be, what do we anticipate the ending fund balance to be at the end of this fiscal year?
I don't have that number. I know we're a lot of the dollars that currently reside in that deal with debt service, and we are moving very quickly with a programmed strategy to play out and issue bonds specific to the OTIA packages, as well as the Connect Oregon as they come into play. That will have significant impact on the migration of the ending fund balance. But Mr. Chairman, Senator, I have to get you the specifics as we play itself out. I don't have that in front of me right now.
Then another question. We have indicated that approximately 25% have been delayed, projects that are delayed. Presumably they have federal funds in these projects. And in the statement here in the LFO analysis, if all the formula funds are not obligated in the year they were provided, the unused portion will be used in other states. It long predates probably the tenure of most all of your department, but I recall a period of time in the state of Oregon when we walked over millions and millions of dollars in federal monies because we weren't geared up to handle them in the way that we should have. And my question is, have we lost federal funding as a result of these delays?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morse, no. Not that I know of. As a matter of fact, the obligations in committing these funds, we actually advance federal funds, so we don't put ourselves in the situation. And more importantly, it allows us to be one of those states that receive the rescinded funds. So we gather funds that aren't spent in other states. They come, and we invest it in the state of Oregon. We have been extremely aggressive for the 10 years I've been at the Department of Transportation in various positions to make sure that we secure and that we invest and spend those funds and that are obligated, move them quickly, and stand ready to pick up any other state that might not be in that position.
Thank you.
DAS recommendation to accept.
Chair Jim Carboni with the Department of Administrative Services. DAS does recommend acknowledgement of this report.
Ms. Jordan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Legislative Fiscal Office also recommends acknowledging receipt of the report, and note that Legislative Fiscal Office will be working closely with the department to monitor and their use of these funds.
Are there any additional questions or comments? Is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we acknowledge receipt of the report.
Any additional questions or comments? Hearing none, motion passes. Senator Morse, will you carry?
Yes.
You'll be the hardest working one of us tomorrow.
This likely will be on the consent agenda.
Yes.
Not tomorrow. Oh, no.
No.
Really? All the consent agenda items.
You're here all day tomorrow.
Sure, all the consent reports have already gone through subcommittee as a consent. Yeah.
Okay.
Motion passes, and Senator Morse will carry. Final item on the agenda, agenda item number 50.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, it's truly a privilege to share this piece of information with you. We're here for two reasons, to kind of give you an update and a status report of where we are with regard to the Connect Oregon investment that played itself out in 2005, but also to ask for an increase in other funds limitation to my department's transportation development program of $20 million, and for the increase in other funds limitation to my sister agency, the Department of Aviation, in the order of $5 million. You'll recall the Connect Oregon conversation was a conversation that was more than transportation. It was truly a conversation clothed in the economic garment. But that said, it was a non-highway a conversation that played itself out in 2005 with $100 million of lottery-backed bonds to fund critical rail, transit, aviation, and marine projects that better connected the system, better connected between the modes, and improve the efficiency and remove potential obstacles and barriers to Oregon firms to move commerce and freight throughout the state of Oregon. A very aggressive timeline was put into place here. Advisory committees were stood up, both in terms of some disciplines that were articulated in the bill, specific advisory committees to the four modes, again, transit, aviation, marine, and rail. Our commission added the area commissions on transportation. I think the Freight Advisory Committee as well brought scrutiny and rigor to the conversation. They culminated their effort, a first vetting of a universe of projects that came in about 2.5 times in terms of dollar application to compete for the $100 million. That culminated May 19th. From then, it transferred to a consensus committee who, for all intents and purposes, met the first week in June and came to a decision, a recommendation that will play itself out before our Transportation Commission on June 29th in Boardman, where they're going to hold a public hearing. And the expectation is our commission will gavel down on the Connect Oregon projects at our July meeting here in Salem on July 19th. I would argue the disciplines and the rigor were brought forth by some of the best and brightest transportation minds we have in the state. I think we have taken a difficult approach in that you're comparing different modes for the first time. You're bringing together different folks who haven't really integrated in conversation and discourse before. But I would argue that the race run to date, the recommendations, again, that are going before our commission next week out in Boardman, is a true signal for success. And I think we've positioned this conversation well as it continues to play itself out. Now, in addition to that, because of the import of the economic conversation surrounding this, we ask for the increase in these limitations to prepare us to move projects as quickly as possible. Again, the projects haven't been selected. That's anticipated come July. But the snapshot of recommendation that we have, we've identified those projects that we can actually make investments in in this biennium and then early into the next biennium. So we can actually move and infuse some of this investment into Oregon's economy immediately. We want to show you and your colleagues, when you come back come January of 2007, that the investment is yielding dividends already. And that's the underpinnings of our request today to ask for these increases in limitation funds.
Mr. Carbone. Department of Administrative Services recommends approval of this request.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends approval of the request with the understanding that Department of Administrative Services will unschedule the limitation until the actual need for expenditure is demonstrated.
I think all the members here probably had mailed to them. I saw the list of the narrowed projects, and I think Representative Scott living in the same area. I've not heard any objections from any of my parties that would normally object. and I happen to be in all three metropolitan counties, and I don't know about Senator Morse where he's at, but I have, so far I've not heard anything back from many of the players.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I may, there are folks that are a little cranky, but that's okay. I think that's part of a robust conversation. I think what it says to me is all the projects had merit. We just ran out of money. But if indeed we're successful in delivering and executing this program, and I can assure you we are well on our way, I think we positioned ourselves for maybe another conversation to deal with some of these folks that were below a cut line.
Do we have any questions or comments? A motion?
Well, your turn.
Mr. Chair, recommend that we increase the other fund expenditure limitation for the Department of Transportation by $20 million for the Transportation Development Program and increase other funds expenditure limitation for the Department of Aviation by $5 million for the implementation of Senate Bill 71 with the understanding the Department of Administrative Services will unschedule the limitation until the actual cost for expenditures is demonstrated.
Thank you. Any additional discussion? Any objections to the motion? Hearing none, motion passes. I will carry 50. With that, we are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. President.